It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, consumers today have a whole lot of streaming services to sort through when they cut the cord from cable TV. A technology reporter helps us figure out what we need to watch what we want. First, victims of domestic abuse or gang violence in other countries will now have a harder time applying for asylum in the United States. Attorney General Jeff Sessions unveiled new limitations on asylum seekers yesterday. He said that victims of personal crimes do not qualify as members of particular social groups that are eligible for asylum, those based on race, religion, nationality, or political opinion. Sessions said Obama-era policies have created powerful incentives for people to come to the U.S. illegally and claim a fear of return.
The asylum system is being abused to the detriment of the rule of law, sound public policy, public safety even, and to the detriment of people with just claims to asylum.
Immigrants' rights groups quickly condemned the ruling, saying it could put tens of thousands of people in increased risk of abuse or death. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi called the change heartless and inhumane. Rick Sue is a professor of law at the University at Buffalo. He's an expert in immigration law and policy and teaches a class on refugee and asylum law. Rick, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
What is your reaction to the Attorney General's announcement limiting who's eligible for asylum?
So on the one hand, it's disturbing, but on the other hand, not unexpected. In some ways, this has been an issue that's been brewing for a long time. And given the signs that Jeff Sessions has been laying out, I think this particular opinion itself was expected.
What changes after this announcement?
So the big thing that changes, at least most directly, is with regard to domestic violence. So this case is directly on whether or not domestic violence would constitute a ground for asylum in this particular country under U.S. law. But a bigger issue, actually, is about whether or not private criminal activity or activity in which there is a non-governmental actor like gang violence, but nonetheless is in a country which is unable or unwilling to patrol these particular type of activities would be grounds. And this, of course, would be broader than domestic violence. It would include a lot of other situations, many of which we're seeing today.
Right. The Attorney General is going toward a definition of asylum, which is a long-running tradition, saying that this is about somebody fleeing some form of government or public oppression based on what category they're in. Is that a valid summary of his argument?
Yeah, it is. And I think it goes back to a long-running debate in asylum law about where do we consider, you know, certainly when the government itself is doing some sort of activity or society itself is persecuting a group, that falls within the grounds. The problem is if it's the government or society is condoning or allowing something to happen, there's some sort of culture in a particular community or some sort of unstated policy of the government, would that be covered? And that seems to be the running debate for a while. And this clearly comes out in the terms of we want very explicit government action, or at least government inability or unwillingness to control a particular activity, as opposed to just sort of an institutional, structural, or societal tolerance of a particular activity.
So in the case under the Obama administration that allowed domestic violence as a valid claim of asylum, and in this case that Attorney General Sessions is overturning, the case seems to be a woman in a relationship, in a marriage, was subject to long-term domestic violence, and the government was unwilling, unable to protect her. Police visits in some of these cases, but no change in the domestic violence situation. That was at the core of both of these cases, right?
That is, and this has actually been going along way before the Obama administration. There was a earlier case, which Jeff Sessions also talks about. So this has been going on since the Clinton administration, and this has been a thorny issue. And it really comes down actually to this broader topic, which actually is very relevant today, about whether or not gender and sex by itself would be something considered as a protected ground. We certainly know that there is discrimination and sometimes persecution on the basis of gender and sex. But of course, it's such a big category. So in some ways, this is the underlying question, is are we going to recognize, especially when a government or more specifically a society tolerates a particular type of activity against women in particular, whether or not that would be treated as the ground for asylum or not.
The Attorney General further seems to be suggesting that people are, whether they have a valid claim that they're subject to domestic violence or gang violence, when they come in seeking asylum, they throw that out there. And he says, in effect, They're gumming up the system by making this claim they're entering into a hearing process, able to stay in this country. Is there anything to that?
Well, I think there definitely is all these things are sort of connected with this sort of Jeff Sessions and President Trump's no-tolerance policy, right? The idea that there are too many individuals trying to use the law to gain admission to the United States. So certainly there is an instrumental aspect to this. I think there is a sense that if we eliminate all these claims, that it would streamline the process and less individuals will have the opportunity to stay here. The deeper question, of course, is, of course, we can eliminate all sorts of claims. The deeper question is whether or not eliminating these particular claims is following or against either the letter or the spirit of the law. Now, of course, Jeff Sessions is arguing here that this was not what was authorized by Congress or our international obligations. But I think that is the bigger question underlying it, is that does our sort of domestic concerns about numbers or individuals that are seeking to come to the country affect our international and domestic obligations to provide asylum to those who are at risk?
Talking to Rick Hsu, professor of law at the University at Buffalo, looking at Attorney General Jeff Sessions' announcement saying that domestic violence and gang violence, for the most part, won't be viewed now as a valid claim of asylum in the United States. Rick, a lot of my questions so far have been more in the abstract. What are the practical consequences of this? You said off the bat this is a disturbing change. What is this going to mean for women seeking asylum?
Well, for women seeking asylum, it would mean that the practice since 2014 of alleging either domestic violence or some sort of ground that's based primarily on their gender, that they're being specifically targeted because of the gender or sex, and how that affects different relationships, whether they're married or oftentimes in the case of gang violence, they're targeted by a specific gang member who may be seeking their affection or whatnot. It makes all those claims much more difficult. It seems to be that the consequence would be that the group that they would have to define, which is the particular social group, which is what Congress designated as being able to seek protection, would have to be defined a lot more narrowly and very specifically, and in a way that would be distinct from what they are being targeted for and targeted by. So that would raise some particular difficulties there. The second biggest consequence, I think, out of this is I think Jeff Sessions is specifically saying that a lot more evidence would have to be demonstrated or shown in order to prove each of the particular elements. And there are many. But in this particular case, when he assessed the lower court, the BIA opinion, he seemed to suggest there that not sufficient evidence was presented and that the BIA was wrong to essentially overrule even a lower court, the immigration judge, in saying that the evidence was sufficient.
Is this likely to have the practical effect that some women who are suffering long-term domestic violence will be sent back to that situation?
Almost certainly, I think, in this book. I think the risk is definitely very high, although Jeff Sessions leaves out the possibility that a legitimate claim on domestic violence can be made. I think this opinion should be read as a categorical sort of rejection on domestic violence claims or claims based very specifically on a gender persecution in a particular country that may have issues with gender inequality or discrimination.
I guess I want to take this to a fundamental point of asylum law. Why do we have this process of asylum outside of the legal sense? Is there a moral case for how we use asylum law and who we apply it to?
Yeah, there is definitely a moral case. And we have to remember that the asylum, both the international obligation and the particular U.S. asylum statute, really came out of World War II. And the Holocaust, I think, was a big in people's minds when this entire system was developed, and including many countries, including the United States, who turned away individuals that were fleeing early persecution that then became the Holocaust, and then seeing the outcome out of that. So out of that, there was, I think, a strong both humanitarian sensitivity, but also in some ways an international relations sensitivity, that if a country persecutes its own citizens or if a country does not protect its own citizens, right, the idea that a citizen deserves the protection of their country, that is both not only a humanitarian concern, but a problem for our international system. And that, I think, persisted for a long time. But I think with all things related to immigration, as time goes on and domestic opposition arises, the fundamental perception of the protections and the statute starts changing. Immigration advocates and scholars sort of observe that it used to be the case that asylum was one of the sort of categories in the immigration system that would usually be seen as sympathetic. But it seems like in recent years that trend has switched, that the general perception among the public about asylees is certainly not as sympathetic as it was before.
Is there a case to be made that, okay, maybe the United States should be applying diplomatic and moral persuasion to these countries to say, you need to deal with domestic violence in a different way? That would be maybe a more effective use of U.S. policy than asylum as a first resort.
Yeah, and I think that's definitely the case, and it's always been imagined in some ways that both granting individual asylum cases and then, of course, in the international community, exerting some sort of pressure or maybe some sort of persuasion to get countries to not persecute or to change their sort of culture or perception to certain minority groups would be important. But I think in recent years, asylum has in the past been connected to sort of State Department activities and international relations. But I would say that in recent decades, that link has also been severed, that it's been seen as more as a domestic immigration concern. And although there are statements oftentimes of, well, it's better that they stay there and we provide some sort of support, it seems like the second part of that has really not come up much. And, of course, we're seeing most of the issues in Central America, and really in three countries in particular. And although there's a lot of concerns about them coming, there doesn't seem to be a lot of engagement with those particular countries and the level of violence and the culture there.
Rick, thanks for joining us today.
No problem.
Rick Hsu is a professor of law at the University at Buffalo. He's an expert in immigration law and policy and teaches a class on refugee and asylum law. We talked with him about Attorney General Jeff Sessions' decision to block asylum for most victims of domestic abuse and gang violence. Right now, whether it's Netflix, Hulu, or the many choices for on-demand live TV streaming, consumers now have a lot of alternatives to consider for their TV viewing. And because of these ever-expanding viewing options, fewer people are committing to traditional cable TV packages. Some cable providers have responded by offering up their own pared-down channel packages or skinny bundles in order to compete. It gets confusing. David Katzmeyer joins us now to help sort it all out. He's senior editor of home theater and TV reviews for CNET. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
No problem, Rob. Good afternoon.
Well, I think people might think, okay, I'm going to stop paying that monthly cable bill. There's so much out there I can do. But once they do that, there are a lot of decisions to make. Where do people get started?
Well, the biggest thing you have to figure out if you're going to decide to cut cable is, whether you want live TV, whether you want to keep, your local channels, your CNNs, your ESPNs, or whether you just want to get rid of all of that and go to a strictly video-on-demand palette, which includes the Netflixes, Amazons, and services like that. A lot of people have a lot easier time maybe weaning themselves off of, the channel, the cable packages they have by going with one of these live TV streaming services.
And these are new to me, really. I know about the Netflix and Hulu things. I still have the cable. Can't get away from the sports. We'll talk about that in a bit. Tell us about these streaming live TV services. What are they? How do they work?
So the first one was Sling TV, which is interesting because Sling is actually owned by Dish Network, the satellite provider. The idea, it came out a couple of years ago, and it gives you basically a small number of live TV channels, the main, most expensive one being ESPN, for $20 a month. So that's really cool. You can get kind of the best of cable, they call it, for a really low price. The downside is that you don't get any over-the-air TV channels, your standard networks, including ABC, NBC, CBS, and Fox. So those are available, again, over-the-air with an antenna connected to your TV, but Sling TV doesn't give you those. So you kind of have to cobble together a solution if you want, kind of the basic channels that are out there.
That's Sling. What are some of the other streaming TV services, and how do they compare?
So Sling is the cheapest, the $20 a month, and then it goes up from there. So DirecTV Now, which, again, is owned by a satellite company, is $35 a month, and actually have a really good selection of channels, including those local channels for a lot of places in the country. And then there's YouTube TV, which is $40 a month, PlayStation View, and Hulu with live TV. So all of those around $40 a month give you a larger selection of channels, And with some of these services, you can add additional, more expensive channel packages, just like you can with cable, and step up and get, you know, pretty close to a cable TV service in terms of breadth of channels. But then you're pretty close to not saving any money. You might actually be spending more.
Right. And if I do one of those, do I get, say, everything that Netflix has to offer? Or if I get a non-Hulu one, do I get all of that? Am I going to cobble one package with the other streaming services I might already have?
Yeah, you're going to have to because, again, most people already have Netflix. That's kind of the baseline for a lot of people that are getting into streaming. So you're going to have to pay for that package. You're going to have to open that app separately. Each of these services has its own app that you have to open separately. Same thing with Amazon. Hulu's nice because if you get their live TV package, then you can include, you know, the same interface, the same app that'll give you the live TV plus all that you get from Hulu, which is thousands of on-demand TV shows. But it does require a lot more work than a cable subscription, just in terms of what you have to do, the devices that you have to use, and that kind of thing. And in my experience, it can be a little bit less reliable than cable. You know, you do have to deal with your own internet, so if you don't have the greatest Wi-Fi all over the house, for example, some TVs might not get the best streaming connection. And sometimes the service itself is interrupted, especially in really popular, you know, primetime events. For example, we just had the NBA Finals. There's plenty of people complaining about that particular sports broadcast, you know, cutting out on some of these services.
Talking to David Katzmeier from CNET about the alternatives to traditional cable. Weird to call it traditional. It hasn't been around that long in the scope of human history. David, we mentioned that cable companies, well, they don't want to lose all this business. They're offering some of them these skinny bundles now in response. So what is that?
So that's just a really small number of channels, and the idea there is to get you to continue to, you know, have the cable service in your house for television. And for a lot of people, they're a really good bargain. You know, again, it's responding to this. They wouldn't have done it, you know, a couple of years ago before these services were, you know, really popular. But now they have to respond to this competition, and their response is to offer, you know, a lot less expensive, you know, a selection of channels. The thing is, to get one of these live TV streaming services, whether it's you know, a DirecTV Now, Sling TV, or even a Netflix, you're going to have to subscribe to you know, a broadband internet access at your house, and the cable company controls that. So you have to pick up the phone and call your cable company and say, "Hey, look, I want to quit my cable TV, but you know, get live internet or continue to get my internet package." And they'll turn around and say, "Okay, well, maybe you'll save $20, $30, $40 a month, depending on where you live." And if you turn around and begin to subscribe to one of these live TV packages or, you know, a selection of Hulu plus Netflix plus Amazon, for example, you can start to ramp up your costs again. So you really have to pay attention, if you're doing this to save money, which most people are, to your current cable TV package and how much you're actually going to save when you get your required broadband internet without television.
We're here in Wisconsin. We like our sports, the Packer games, Big Ten, all the sports. In my household, there's a lot of football. The kids are watching World Cup coming up, the English Premier League. For sports fans, if they want to get away from that full-on cable subscription, how do you cobble all that together?
Well, you can do it. Again, these new live TV subscription services are usually the best way to do it. YouTube TV, for example, has really good coverage of a lot of sports. It starts with the local channels, you know, NBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox, which carry NFL games, for example. A lot of the big sporting events are on these broadcast channels. If you want to follow a particular basketball or professional baseball team, however, you're probably going to need to make sure that one of these services has your particular regional sports network. In New York, those are SNY and YES Network, for example, for the Mets and Yankees, respectively. Those types of channels are pretty expensive, you know, because they have a monopoly on the regular season games of baseball and a lot of other sports. So you have to look at the package itself. You can do it, but it all depends on what teams you really want to follow.
David, it all sounds like it gets pretty complicated pretty quick. If people just want to stay with the cable, you wrote in one of your pieces, maybe it's worth calling and negotiating with the cable company.
Yeah, you can do that too, especially if you have a second cable company serving your area. But now that all these services are available, you can say, "Hey, look, I'm streaming. I put together this package, and you know, including your lowest internet streaming cost plus XYZ service, and it comes out to, let's say, $100 a month. Right now, you know, I'm giving you guys $150 a month for the same TV. How about you match that? How about we have a new two-year contract? How about you guys come down? And you can find that they'll often be willing to negotiate, especially if the alternative is losing you as a customer and losing a lot of your monthly fee.
And David, what are some of the best devices for watching our various subscription channels, streaming services, whatnot?
Well, my favorite overall is the Roku system. Roku is the least expensive out there. It's, you know, you can get one for $30. It performs very well. Again, you can kind of spread that around to your secondary TVs. The other really good one, I think, is Apple TV, which is at the other end of the spectrum. It starts at $150. The 4K version is $180. It's a really good experience. But, you know, it's also a little bit more money, and you don't really need it. You know, if you're watching TV, the apps are basically their own little universes, and they're going to perform very similarly no matter what device you're using. So it really comes down to what's the easiest one to use, and Roku is pretty much my pick for that.
Briefly, as we wrap up, David, it seems like things are changing so quickly. New services pop up. Is the decision somebody makes today still going to be the smart one a year from now?
Well, you know what? That's probably the best thing about all this change happening is that it's happening so quickly that you're not locked into one of these services. All of these services are a month-to-month thing. So if you decide you don't want to watch Sling and you don't like its interface, you want to try out YouTube TV, you can, and it costs you basically nothing. You're not locked into contracts anymore. It's really easy, just a click of a couple mouse strokes, to go from one to the other. And they work on your phones. You know, there's a lot of things that make them better than television as we know it. So this space is evolving very quickly. I think some companies are going to go away, and some might even get better in the next year or so. So I don't think it's going to be like it is now. It's just going to continue to get better. And competition, as usual in this country, is going to help people get better choices for their entertainment.
David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right, no problem.
That's David Katzmeier, senior editor of home theater and TV reviews for CNET. He's been breaking down the various options for people looking to move away from cable TV service. If you spend any time in a grocery store or on the internet, you've probably seen product taglines like made by real people, or locally produced, or only natural ingredients, or heard an ad like this.
At Whole Foods Market, we believe in food that's naturally beautiful and fresh. Delicious and powerful and full of nutrients. Food that makes us nourished and mighty and connects us to the natural world. So there are no artificial colors, no artificial flavors, no artificial preservatives in any of the food we sell. We believe in real food. Whole Foods Market.
Those words can make it difficult for you to know what you're getting and to balance the claims of one product against the other, especially when it comes to trying to limit your family's exposure to potentially harmful chemicals. Nora McKendrick is a professor in the sociology department at Rutgers University in New Jersey. Her new book is Better Safe Than Sorry: How Consumers Navigate Exposure to Everyday Toxics. Nora, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. It's great to be here.
Well, first of all, you talked to a lot of people about how they approach these issues and how they try to scout out what the most healthy or at least least harmful products are. One thing you came across is it seems confusing to a lot of people.
Yeah, that's right. I did talk to a lot of people. I've done this research now in Toronto, and I've done this research in New York City, talking to mothers who tend to be the ones who are making these decisions. They do most of the grocery shopping. They're making the grocery list, and they're the ones that are thinking most about the chemicals that are in their food and the food they feed their families. And many of them did find shopping their way out of chemical exposure to be pretty complicated. They were confused by labels. They didn't know whether they could trust certain claims. And they were on the internet, as you mentioned a moment ago, doing research, trying to find out, okay, what is a paraben, and should I avoid that in my baby skincare lotion or in my own lotion? Some of them talked about being overwhelmed and exhausted by the work that it took to avoid chemicals through shopping.
And you write that while some people have said, hey, we're too worried about what's in our food and our personal products, you say there's actually reason for people to be concerned. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, there's a stereotype out there that mothers who are reading these labels and are worried about the chemicals in their food and in their consumer products are overly anxious, or chemophobes is a word that comes up sometimes. But as it turns out, there's a lot of scientific evidence now that suggests that regular, so chronic exposure to chemicals in our food and our consumer products is cause for concern. A lot of it depends on when we're exposed. And early life exposure, so that means exposure in utero, so during fetal development, infancy, childhood, exposure to certain toxic compounds at this life stage can set the stage for things like cancer, neurological disorders, diabetes, obesity, and the list goes on. And mothers are increasingly aware of this. They're reading it in their pregnancy advice books, and some of them are even hearing about it from their doctors.
And you say there's a reasonable lack of trust from consumers based on histories of products like lead used in lead paints and other products.
Yeah. In the United States, there's a history of government regulators, so regulators at the federal level, prioritizing industry expansion and development at the expense of public health and the environment. So there's a history, not just with lead, but with other compounds as well, where evidence emerges that a compound is problematic, possibly toxic, and government drags its feet because industry typically pushes back and says, wait, we need to wait for this scientific evidence to pile up and show us that this compound is indeed toxic. Meanwhile, in other jurisdictions, like in the European Union, it's a different standard that's used. Industry has to prove that a compound is safe before it can be used. In the United States, it's different. The EPA and other regulators have to prove that a compound is harmful in order to institute restrictions, or they'll face backlash from industry.
Talking to Nora McKendrick, her new book is Better Safe Than Sorry, How Consumers Navigate Exposure to Everyday Toxics. And a heart of what goes into a lot of these decisions people make that you found, you call precautionary consumption. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so I came up with that term because I realized that when people are standing at in the grocery store and they're looking at the shelf and they're picking up a product and they're reading the ingredient label, many of them are making precautionary judgments. They're looking at those ingredients and saying, okay, this product is for sale at the grocery store. Somebody has allowed it to be here. It has presumably been vetted by someone, which in fact, it probably hasn't, as I learned doing research for my book. But the consumer is standing there and saying, well, is it okay? You know, should I buy something with parabens or phthalates or artificial colors or artificial flavors? Or should I err on the side of caution and just avoid those things altogether? So I realized what consumers were doing was they were applying this kind of precautionary principle, but at the individual level when they were at the grocery store. And everybody has their own set of standards. For some people, it's fine to have artificial colors and artificial flavorings, but they don't want to be exposed to much plastic, so they're avoiding that. For other people, it has to be organic all around, from the meat and vegetables to everything.
And you write, and you mentioned earlier, a lot of this falls to mothers who are either pregnant or raising their infants, their kids. And there's a lot of trying to protect health here, but a lot of guilt in some ways that goes into these decisions. Can you talk about the quandary a lot of moms are finding themselves in?
Yeah, there is a lot of guilt when it comes to feeding children. I've learned this from my research. I've learned this from my colleagues' research, like Jose Johnston at the University of Toronto writes about this, and Kate Cairns at Rutgers Camden writes about this. Feeding children and shopping for children is an activity that not very many mothers enjoy doing. It's filled with guilt. You know, am I feeding my child the right thing? Are they eating enough fruits and vegetables? Is their diet balanced? And then added to these very basic concerns now is the question of, well, should I be giving my child organic food exclusively? For many families, that's impossible. It's just too expensive, or it takes too much time, or they just don't have all organic options available to them, depending on where they live. with that, with those trade-offs, with those choices, comes a lot of guilt. So I had mothers say things like, well, you know, I found some beautiful grapes that were on sale. You know, they were like $1.99 a pound, and they just looked wonderful. But I was wondering, could I feed these to my kids, knowing that they're conventional, that is not organic, so grown with pesticides and fungicides, et cetera? Or should I just not give my child grapes and give and wait to give him certified organic grapes that I can find at another store when they go on sale? So these small calculations that mothers are making every day. And sometimes mothers would say they did feel guilty giving their kids, you know, conventional strawberries or not spending the extra money on organic meat and organic dairy. And in fact, as I learned, it's very hard to do that. It's very expensive, and very few of us can really afford to do that on a regular basis.
Yeah, you write that there's a stereotype that most of the people and most of the moms weighing these issues are going to be middle class, upper class, mostly white moms. You found that that wasn't true.
Yeah, I found that wasn't true, and I realized that this is a stereotype that we have that probably goes back to when, you know, green shopping and eco shopping first became popular, sort of in the 80s and 90s. It was mainly white, middle class, upper class consumers that were spending the extra money on eco-friendly products. But now we're seeing a big expansion in interest, especially in organic foods, from Black consumers, Latino consumers. And in my research, I found that lower-income women were also thinking about this. And for those who could afford to the time to buy, to compare prices across different supermarkets, they could actually buy some organic foods on a limited budget. Now, I didn't interview anyone who was really low income, so really kind of chronic poverty, really unable to make ends meet. But I did interview people who were on lower incomes and who had been on food stamps for a time period, and they were able to do it, but what they had to invest was time. They had to do their shopping at a discount store where they knew certain organic products were a really good bargain, and then go to another store where other products were a good bargain. And by doing that, they could actually buy a fair amount of organic for their families. But it was even more exhausting for them. And while they saved money, they did have to spend a lot of time doing it.
We're talking to Nora McKendrick, professor in the sociology department at Rutgers University in New Jersey. We're talking about her new book called Better Safe Than Sorry, How Consumers Navigate Exposure to Everyday Toxics. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you try to assess the safety of the products you're buying? How do you balance the claims of one product against another? Are you willing to pay more when you can for items that seem safer, or does budget have to take the highest priority for you? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We continue the conversation about chemicals in foods and how consumers can be better educated about what is and isn't in the products they buy and how people make these decisions. Nora McKendrick is a professor in the sociology department at Rutgers University in New Jersey. Her new book is called Better Safe Than Sorry, How Consumers Navigate Exposure to Everyday Toxics. Want to hear your story at 800-642-1234. Is this you? Do you weigh local commercial produce against long-distance traveling but organic produce? Do you read those labels? Do you understand them? I don't. Do you try to figure out what is right for you, for your kids, for your family? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. Aaron is with us in Sturgeon Bay. Aaron, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I made the switch to organics a couple years ago. I stopped eating meat about 10 years ago. And learning about glyphosate, which is the horrible chemical in Roundup, they've even found it in mother's breast milk. It's so pervasive. I don't want to put any of it in my body. It's very, very bad for you. I found there's a local store here, Pick and Save. They have quite a good selection of really high-quality, low-cost, organic food.
Aaron, thanks a lot for the call. Nora, that's similar to a lot of the stories you heard from people worried about maybe a particular chemical and going as organic as they are able to in their area.
Yeah, consumers are learning a lot about what is in their food, and the case of glyphosate, which is a compound in Roundup, which is made by Monsanto, which is soon to be Bayer. They've been bought by Bayer. That was recently announced. And that's been making the news lately because different environmental groups who happen to be the ones who are really testing our foods to find out what pesticide residues are in there have revealed that glyphosate is in so many of the things that we buy. Now, the United States Environmental Protection Agency maintains that glyphosate is safe. It doesn't pose a harm to human health, but we're learning through the European Union and the World Health Organization that glyphosate may be a probable carcinogen, and now there are lawsuits ongoing in California that have asked Monsanto to open up their email archives, and it's revealing that a lot of the studies that Monsanto has used to maintain that glyphosate is safe were produced by scientists that were paid by Monsanto. And so lawyers and scientists and defendants are sorting through all of this information right now. We'll learn more about what's happening in California. But that is one of the concerns that I've heard about, or people just mention pesticide residues in general.
Erin, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Lucy in Madison. Lucy, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to put it out there that Environmental Working Group is an organization, EWG, and basically one of the things that they do is rate products, skin products, by what kind of toxins are in the product. So they rate cosmetics and sunscreen and all sorts of lotions and shampoos and things. So if people want to know, if people are unsure of what to buy, that would be a good place to look, I think.
Lucy, thanks for the call. And Nora, you referenced the Environmental Working Group, I think, quite a bit in your book.
Yeah, I do, because the Environmental Working Group, as this caller pointed out, does have all of these rating and ranking systems for, they have the Dirty Dozen list, which tells us which fruits and vegetables have the highest levels of pesticide residues. It has a skin deep database that allows you to go in and look up your skin lotion, your shampoo, and find out if there are probable carcinogens in there or endocrine disruptors. And it also ranks sunscreen every year. You know, June every year it comes out with a sunscreen list. And what I argue in the book is that groups like Environmental Working Group have really stepped in to fill the gap that regulators have left, because consumers no longer trust what they're buying, and for good reason. There are serious regulatory gaps where products haven't been adequately tested before they reach the market. In fact, many products are never tested, or the compounds that go into them are never tested before they go to market. So we have environmental groups like Environmental Working Group and others that test these products and tell us what to buy. And so they have apps that you can use. You can go to their website. And so that's what I find consumers are turning to. They're turning to these groups to tell them what to do.
Thanks for that call, Lucy, at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Nora McKendrick. Her new book is Better Safe Than Sorry, How Consumers Navigate Exposure to Everyday Toxics. Back to your calls now. Bob is with us in Madison. Bob, hi.
Hey, Rob and Nora. I just wanted to make the comment that I know a little bit about vegetable production, and I do choose organic as a function of what chemicals are used in the conventional production. For example, potatoes, I always buy organic because the conventional production requires a lot of chemical input, whereas onions are actually relatively chemical-free or pesticide-free in conventional production, and I rarely buy organic onions.
Bob, thanks a lot. So kind of a triage there, Nora, and we hear that, you know, the Dirty Dozen vegetable list, people picking and choosing these vegetables or fruits might have more pesticides than these others, selecting organic accordingly.
That's right. EWG, and we were talking about them a moment ago, they have a list called the Clean 15. I can't remember if onions are on the Clean 15, but certainly fruits and vegetables that require very few chemical inputs are on that list. So that helps. Again, this is part of this toolkit that consumers can use to pick the safest or lowest chemical foods overall. So it's true that some vegetables don't require a lot of chemical inputs, but again, we're looking to these environmental advocacy groups to tell us what to buy when, as I argue in the book, we really need our regulators, like the Environmental Protection Agency, the FDA, the USDA, to do a better job of vetting our products before they reach the market.
And I wanted to get into that point, Nora. You know, we could all get a PhD in biochemistry and research, look at all these papers and lawsuits around the world. You're hoping to take some of the heat off of the individual consumers, the moms in particular. What kind of changes at federal agencies that you were just mentioning would you like to see to put everyone's mind a little more at ease?
Well, the changes I ask for in the book are big. And one reason they're so big is that it turns out, and I was surprised by this when I did research for the book, that our food and our consumer products have never been particularly well regulated in the United States. There's always been this tension, this power struggle between consumers, manufacturers, and government. And manufacturers or industries usually held most of the power in this relationship. And I was surprised to see that, you know, from the early 1900s through to now. When I started writing this book, it was at a time when there were major reforms happening to the Toxic Substances Control Act, which was an act that was put into place in 1976. It was flawed from the beginning. It's basically what allows so many things to hit the market without ever being, without the chemical compounds that make them up, ever being tested for their safety. And there were huge bipartisan efforts to try to reform this law to make it more precautionary. In other words, to evaluate things a bit more carefully before putting them on the market. And then as I was finishing up the book, of course, we had a change in administration. And now the Environmental Protection Agency is being led by Scott Pruitt, who's made a very bold change to the agency and, in fact, is rolling back even these modest improvements that were put into place in 2016. So I say that the changes that we need are big because they are big. They will require massive changes in how we think about the role of government in the marketplace. And I look to the European Union as just one example of how we could do that. But even states like California have mechanisms in place where they are looking at chemicals batch by batch and trying to determine, you know, which chemicals are safe and which chemicals should be taken off the market. And if we have states like California lead the way, then manufacturers will follow because that's a huge market for them. So there are some big changes and there are some smaller changes too. We're seeing retailers respond like Target and CVS saying that they won't carry products with certain compounds in them because of pressure they're getting from environmental groups, health groups, and consumers.
We'll leave it there for now. Nora, thanks a lot for joining us today. That was Nora McKendrick, professor in the sociology department at Rutgers University in New Jersey. We've been talking about her new book. It's called Better Safe Than Sorry, How Consumers Navigate Exposure to Everyday Toxics. You can keep the conversation going on over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. How do you choose consumer products, food products when you go shopping? Are you a label reader? Are there ingredients you avoid? Do you feel overwhelmed? What do you think of our guest's suggestion of more stringent regulation of the various chemicals that go into foods and other consumer products? Let us know what you think. You can join in on the conversation over at the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. The rise and fall of video stores is a story that's still going on. And Chris Molina, you are mourning the passing of a video store in your area.
Well, yeah, there was a family video store in Middleton, Wisconsin, which I just heard today is going to be closing. They're clearing out all their inventory. You know, I feel fondly towards all the video stores because that's something that I remember as a kid, you know, going to Blockbuster, seeing what was out there. And even in this age of streaming, like there's something, you know, we were talking earlier in the show about there are so many options. Where do you get good advice from? you can't beat the guy at the video counter.
And you were still going to the video store and renting stuff.
Well, I got to admit, I hadn't been there in a while, and I was actually looking for some of their clearance stuff when it was there.
I was
actually buying stuff. I was thwarting the model just a little bit, but I had still been there. But I recently learned that there's another branch of Family Video. There's a pizza store next door, and I guess if you order online with your pizza, they will actually deliver your pizza and a movie if you want it, which I think is just fantastic.
Yeah, there's a lot of memories attached to wandering around the aisles of a video store, being overwhelmed with choice, trying to decide. I remember when video rental first came out, it was at the corner store, party store, as we called them in Michigan. It's something I kind of miss.
I miss, you know, and I miss putting the little the VHS tape in the box and hearing that kind of satisfying, when it hit the bottom. So I'm not going to miss paying the late fee that, you know, after I took it back after 2 or 3 weeks, but I will miss the ka-thunk.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.